Okay, good morning. Welcome back to Meet the Mefarshim. And today we're going to meet the Rashbam. And we're going to have in mind, first of all, my mother, Rachel Bas David Tzvi, as well as my grandmother, whose yard site is this Thursday, Rosh Chodesh. Some kind of, we're observing it. She has a complicated yard site date, actually. She passed away Lamed Adar Aleph last year. So it's actually complicated to figure out, because there is no Lamed Adar if it's not a leap year. So there's actually two different opinions brought down when you observe. Is it Rosh Chodesh Adar, Rosh Chodesh Nisan? But we're doing Rosh Chodesh Nisan. So that's my grandmother Chana Friedel Bas Avram, as well as Menachem Mendel Meir Ben Yehoshua. So most all Shalom Aleichem. Okay, Rashbam. Rashbam is very excited. Rashbam is a Rishon, one of the early commentators, relatively early. They approximate his birth date around 1085, so quite early. Does anybody know anything about the Rashbam? About his family?
Rashi's grandson.
There we go. Okay. Number one, Rashi's grandson. So we'll speak about that in a moment. He passed away.
Was his grandson?
Yeah, well,
Rashi died when he was very young, right? No, when Rashbam was I think he was 8 or 10, right?
Was that young?
I don't think so. I think that they had a lot of learning Torah interactions. I think Rashbam was actually a major disciple of Rashi's.
Yeah.
But we'll get to that in a little bit. The different approximations of when he passed away. Rashbam, somewhere between late 1150s to early 1170s. Again, we don't have exact dates. Some claim exact dates, but it's hard to know. I guess you can try to find his.
There he is. That's Rashbam. So that guy is.
Okay,
so if Rashi died, he's about 20.
Okay.
When he died.
Rashbam by. So who?
Rabbeinu Tam was a younger brother.
Yes.
Okay.
So Rashbam. So Rashbam stands for Rabbi Shmuel Ben Meir. The reason he was called this is that he was a rabbi. His first name was Shmuel, and his father's name was Meir. So they thought it'd be good to put it together, Rabbi Shmuel Ben Meir. And that's Rashbam. That's what it stands for. He was born in France, in Troyes, right? Written out as a Troyes, but it's pronounced Troyes. It's in Hebrew. I forgot how it's written also. It's very, like, a lot of, like, aleph's and things like that. Something. I forgot exactly how it's spelled. But it's a Troyes in France, and he lived in France his whole life in Tsarfat. And by trade, he actually had a couple of different professions. One was the family business. Does anybody know the family business of Rashi?
Vintner.
Right? So he had a vineyard and made grape juice, wine, at least wine. And I'm sure it's very good. Strong French wine. Was the Rashi wine that they sell nowadays? Is that the same way? I'm not sure. And he also actually had sheep. I don't know if he was a shepherd per se. I mean, he had sheep, and he would sell their wool I think probably also sheep milk, goat's milk as well. That was something else that he had going on when he wasn't being a rabbi and changing the world from a spiritual sense and being a tremendous scholar. But he didn't travel too much outside of France. Most of his learning and teaching was done in France. So let's talk about the Ben Meir for a moment. We said Rabbi Shmuel Ben Meir. So who's this Meir? So it's really Rav Meir. His father was a tremendous scholar as well. I believe also a disciple, a Talmud of Rashi. Rashi just we'll have to do at some point. We're probably going to do a Meet the Mefarshim on Rashi. I'm sure everyone knows a little bit about Rashi. He's really the father of all commentators. Is tremendous. He's if there's going to be one commentary printed in a Chumash, it's probably going to be Rashi's, and then you have many more after. And he had many students that are known as the Bali Tosfos often in their commentaries in the Gemara. So if you ever hear about Tosfos in a Gemara, so that they're included there. Rabbi Meir, this Rashi's son-in-law, was also one of these Bali Tosfos. And he had, Rashi had a few daughters. Anybody know the names of daughters? So oldest one is Yocheved, and he had another one named
Tirza,
Miriam, Yocheved and Miriam. He also had one was quite a bit younger, Rachel. But so his oldest daughter Yocheved married Rashi's oldest daughter. Yocheved married this Rabbi Meir, and then they had three, possibly four sons together. And I believe the oldest of the sons was the Rashbam. He had another brother named whose name was Tam. They no, it wasn't Tam. They called him Rabbeinu Tam, but I'm kidding. His name wasn't Tam. His name was Yaakov. It's like he was from like an Ish Tam. We have the four sons coming up in Pesach Seder. That's a little bit of a negative connotation to Tam. The Tam is like a simpleton. Is often the translation, but really in the Torah, Yaakov Avinu is called an Ish Tam, Yoshev Olam. He's called a wholesome person, right? This Tamimos, wholesome. So Rabbeinu Tam, his name wasn't Thomas. His name was Yaakov. He was the younger son. He also had another brother, Yosef. He was known as the Riva. He's also one of the Baalei Tosfos. Sorry, no, not the Riva. The Rivam. The Rivam. The Riva is a different Baalei Tosfos, but the Rivam is Rav Yosef. I believe it's Rav Yosef ben Meir. Rav Yosef ben Meir, also Rashbam's brother. And you'll see they're quoted in Tosfos a lot. So often if you're learning a Tosfos in the Gemara, so the Tosfos, it will say, the Rabbeinu Tam says this, the Rivam says that. Sometimes it'll quote, Rashbam says this. So these three brothers, the sons of Rav Meir, the son-in-law of Rashi.
Doesn't Rashi sometimes quote Tosfos also? He'll say, like, this is exactly how Tosfos,
Not
am I wrong?
I haven't learned every single Rashi on Shas, so I don't recall seeing it. Tosfos will quote Rashi, right? Often they'll start off with the Kuntrus. They call it Kuntrus often is like a pamphlet. Yeah, you have a better translation of Kuntrus? Yeah, like a pamphlet, but it's referring to like the ultimate pamphlet, the ultimate commentary on the Gemara. Rashi's going to quote it.
Rashi and Tosfos.
I'm sorry.
Were they contemporaries?
Yeah, yes. Well, Tosfos is actually a collection of writings written by French rabbis from a couple hundred years. But the original Baalei Tosfos were grandsons and students of Rashi. So there's a whole group of Baalei Tosfos, but the earlier ones were directly sons-in-law and grandsons and students and grandstudents of Rashi. So Rashi is always like quote Rashi first, even though they challenge him. But that's interesting. Yeah.
So when I'm studying the Oral Torah, the Talmud, it's got like a Baba Mitzi, it's got an opinion from Tosfos and from Rashi in it. But you're saying that when it says Tosfos, it could be more than one Tosfos member.
Yes, yes. Tosfos literally means additions. A Tosafa is or Tosefes is an addition. Tosafos are additions. So they mean ADD, not ADDITION, not EDITION, not addition, audition. Speaking of ADD, I'm going all over the place. But we're talking about they have additions, and the additions were written by many different Baalei Tosfos, the masters of the additions.
So how do I know which one I'm reading?
You don't necessarily, but usually it'll quote within it names. Like it'll say, in the Tosfos, it'll say, Rashbam says this. The Re says this, the Reva says that, Rabbeinu Tam says this. Should often quote the names of that opinion, but yes, it's a little bit more anonymous. It's unclear exactly who's talking in each Tosos. Okay.
So his name wasn't Tom Tosos.
It was not, yeah, it was not Thomas, Thomas, right. Thomas Tosos.
Uncle is perceived
Rashi. A little bit more formal, please.
Yeah. Thomas
Tosos. Uncle is
perceived Rashi. What?
Uncle is perceived Rashi.
Oklos does, yes.
Okay, so Rashi quotes
Oklos. Yes, yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Especially
in like 900 years?
Yeah. Unkelos is from the Tanaic period. He was a contemporary of the Tanaim, quite possibly even Rabbi Akiva. So he was, Unkelos is quite early. Okay, so that's a little bit of the background of his family tree, Rashbam. He had a close relationship with his grandfather. You know, it's my grandfather bought me my tefillin. He took me and bought me my pair of tefillin. I don't know if that happened. At least not with Rashbam's brother, Rabbeinu Tam.
He got his mother's tefillin.
Because he had.
It's not true, by the way. There's no real source of it.
Really?
I've looked that up. It's not a hard fact.
That's a myth. That's a myth.
My wife was just quoting that to me yesterday.
That's a myth. There's no credible source.
It's a modern
that says that Rashi's daughters were tefillin. Not at all. There are sources that they were quite scholarly and literate, which is also a novelty for that around the time. Women. What?
Brewery
wore tefillin. Does Brewery wore tefillin?
It could be.
There is a Gemara that.
White,
um,
white,
She was definitely a scholar. I know that the Gemara does speak about Michal Bas Shaul wearing tefillin, and there's a discussion in the Gemara of is that true? We don't have any righteous women since the times of the Nevi'im who wore tefillin. The Chacham didn't protest, so there's a discussion there. There was some wearing of tefillin from women in France around this time. It wasn't so common, but it wasn't unheard of at the time. But there's no source that indicates that Rashi's daughters themselves were tefillin, though they were seemingly educated, literate, scholarly, and very helpful for Rashi.
So is it prohibited to do that, then?
That's a whole separate thing.
You're not supposed to show your arm.
What?
You're not supposed to show your bare arm. Oh,
yeah, that's usually not brought. I mean, to my knowledge, it's not brought as part of the discussion. But that's a whole separate topic. I'm just talking about the history, and not talking about the halacha. I'm talking about the history of the tefillin. There's a myth about Rabbeinu about Rashbam's mother and aunt. So I'm just dispelling that myth that we don't really have a credible source for that. Okay, some of his personality. So he also, another thing he was involved with disputations against, you know, some of the church making strong statements trying to show the inferiority of Judaism. So he was involved in some of these debates. He was known to be exceedingly modest, often like walking with his eyes down, really carrying himself in a very modest way. Some interesting stories about him looking down so much that he actually once went up onto the back of like a wagon because he wasn't he was like looking down. That was the way he conducted himself. And he wrote on Torah. He wrote on Torah, actually several books of Tanakh, on the Gemara. We don't have a lot of his commentary on the Gemara. There are some places actually where Rashi did not complete his parish on the Gemara. At least we don't have it. In particular, in Arve Pesachim, the 10th parak of Pesachim, which actually is a certain program, an Amud Yomi program that's starting it this week, it's getting ready for Pesach, where you see, there's a commentary of Rashi, and we have the commentary of the Rashbam there as well. We have it in a part of, like, a most of Bava Basra also. We don't have Rashi's commentary there, really, but we do have Rashbam. And he also had books on Diktuk, on Hebrew grammar. So his style on Chumash is very interesting. And if you would take certain comments of Rashbam, for the narrow perspective, so it could actually come off as very controversial. In a sense, it still is controversial, but you would totally misunderstand if you don't get a more full perspective of who Rashbam was. Rashbam makes certain comments. I'm sorry I didn't put them all the sources on the sheet, but he makes certain comments. One that actually we lost a lot of the text of Rashbam, his commentary on Sefer Bereishis. We didn't find it until a little bit more recently. Don't remember precisely when, and there's some of the comments we seem not to have. And he made certain comments about how the day starts during the daytime as opposed to night, right? In Judaism, when does the day start?
At night,
right? Right. Ironic, right? So Friday night is when we do Shabbos. Shabbos isn't Saturday morning. You don't wake up. Okay, Shabbos, you do a Friday night. Mm-hmm. So Rashbam seems to say by the creation of the world, he seems to say that the day starts in the morning time. Right, the 12 hours of the day and the 12 hours of the night. That's one day. That's what Rashbam seems to say over there. This was found very controversial. In fact, it was censored by Jewish printers. Right, we had enough of censoring from the other side for Jewish printers. This comment, I think wrongfully. And he has another comment also, different comment about tefillin, not about his mother wearing them, because we don't know that she did, but rather. His commentary on the simple understanding of wearing tefillin is that when the Torah says you should put on tefillin, doesn't mean you have to. It's not the simple understanding is not that you strap around boxes. It means that you keep you're mindful of the Exodus from Egypt. That you're mindful as if it's like a ribbon around your finger to remember, as if it's something that's constantly on your mind, but not literally that you would put the writings of this on your head and on your arm. That's controversial. What? The Rashbam said that? So did the Rashbam wear tefillin? So the answer is, of course he wore tefillin. Yes, absolutely. Question, did he wear Rabbeinu Tam or Rashi? That I don't know, right? Did he hold like his brother or his Zeta? I don't know.
Well, probably his grandpa more than his little brother.
So
he was wearing tefillin by the time his little brother wasn't even born.
Maybe put on both,
they're 15 years apart.
Right, his Chabad.
Right.
His Chabad. He put on
everywhere.
He would have had to switch later in life. I'm saying he's 15 years older.
So, what I was saying earlier, my grandfather took me to get tefillin. Can you imagine if Rashi, if Rashi bought tefillin for Rashbam, or sorry, Rabbeinu Tam, so they go to the store together, and it's like, okay, we're going to get the Rashi tefillin. It's like, I really, Zadie, I would prefer to have the Rabbeinu Tam, actually. So how did that come about? I assume, here might be a nice proof for you, that the Rashi's daughters did not wear tefillin. This is big chiddush, okay? It's worth the coming here just for the chiddush. I assume, where did Rabbeinu Tam get his tefillin from? He probably held like his father, right? Probably held like his father that it was a particular order. Meaning we call it Rabbeinu Tam tefillin, but Rabbeinu Tam didn't invent that. It was just a different type of, meaning the difference is in the order of the four passages inside. That's the difference between Rabbeinu Tam and Rashi tefillin. So it was just a different approach, and Rabbeinu Tam was a proponent of it. But he got it from his father. But if his mother would have been wearing tefillin, she would have been wearing Rashi tefillin. And then Rabbeinu Tam might have actually taken his mother's tefillin. So it must be that his mother didn't wear tefillin, and he took his father's tefillin, Rabbi Meir's tefillin. Okay. I don't know. Historical fiction, maybe you can call it what you'd like. Okay, so let's take a look. Let's learn a little bit of Torah. Rashbam's actual approach to the Torah. So we have these controversial comments of the Rashbam. Rashbam did wear tefillin. Rashbam was not focusing on his commentary on the Torah is not focusing on halacha and teaching you halacha. Rather, it was to get the simplest interpretation of the psukim. So we're going to take a look at Rashbam's commentary. First, his introduction to Sefer Vayikra. Rashbam, in general, does not have so many lengthy comments. We're going to see a little bit of one of them today. But Rashbam says, in this, right, this is the first source, Vasher sam libo ledavar yotzreinu. For someone who wants to pay attention to the word of our Creator, you want to understand what God's saying? Al Yazuz Minimuke Zikni Rabbeinu Shlomo. Do not move away, do not deviate from the proofs and the comments of my grandfather, Rabbeinu Shlomo, which of course is
Rashi.
Don't leave from them. Because the majority of the halachos and the drashos, the expositions in them, in the words of Rashi, are very close to the simplicity of the text. He says, "V'halashon yesh lamod kulam, you should learn everything." V'tov asher techos baze asher pirashni, and it's good for you to grab what that which I explained. V'gam mizeh al tanach yadecha, and don't leave your hands from this. Parshas v'yikra halachos merubos yeshbo. In Parshas Vayikra, there are a lot of halachos. And those who are wise are going to contemplate and pay close attention to the commentary of my grandfather. Kilo a'aricha, because I'm not going to be long here. I'm not going to be so long in Sefer Vayikra. Only in the places where I need to explain the simplicity of what the text is getting at. But he says, really, you can focus on what Saba says. What my grandfather says, that's really fine. So that's what Rashbam says over here. And it shows that Rashbam saw his commentary as like a supplementary commentary to his grandfather's. So you can't learn Rashbam on his own without seeing the words of Rashi. He saw his as, it's not presented like that in the Chumash. You have a Chumash and you have a bunch of different commentators, but that's how Rashbam saw himself. We're going to turn over just to one page because Rashbam doesn't have a at least not an extant introduction to his parish, right? A lot of Mefarshim, at the beginning of their book, they have a Hakdama. Over here, he had a Hakdama to the third Sefer of the Torah, but he didn't have that in the beginning of the Chumash. But the closest thing is the final source on the second page. This is his commentary to Sefer to Parshas Vayeshev. Right here it says, Ela told Dos Yaakov Yosef. These are the descendants, or these are the chronicles, however you want to interpret it. Rashbam will actually interpret it. Hold off on that. So what does he say? So he says, Yaskilu ve'yavinu o ve'shakoma shilimidunu raboseinu ki ein mikra yotze midei pshuto. The mikra does not leave its simplest interpretation. Meaning, that if the this is important, if the Torah says something and it's read in a certain way in its simplest way, there is a level of truth to that. Right, and a lot of times we might see the others. We know because we know Chazal, right? The sages interpret something one way, and so. But if the simplest version of the text is interpreted a different way, there's also truth to that, right? Your first educated impression. I mean, if you don't know Hebrew, you don't know grammar. There's certain things you don't know, so that doesn't count. But if you know Hebrew grammar, you're paying attention to the context. The simplest interpretation is also meaningful. It doesn't leave me de pshuta. Af ki ikra shel Torah bas lamdeinu l'hodeinu, even though the main part of the Torah is to come and teach us, l'hodeinu, and inform us, b'remizas hapshat, with the hints of the simple understanding, v'ha'agados v'ha'alachos v'adinim, al yidei arichos ha'lashon, I'll just read a little bit more, v'al yidei shlishim v'shtayim midos, Shoshim v'shayim midos shel Rabbi Eliezer ben Osher Rabbi Yosef Glili, v'yidei shalosh esrei midos shel Rabbi Yishmael, the 13 midos of Rabbi Yishmael, we mentioned every morning, Rabbi Yishmael Omer, we mentioned 13 midos. So he says, even though the truth is, the main part of the Torah, the most important thing to take out of the Torah, is all the halachos that are hinted to. Some of them are hinted to by repetitions and by juxtapositions and by an extra letter vav and everything else. And those are all the halachos, and they're passed on through the mesorah, through the oral transmission. And that's the most important thing to get from the Torah. That is the, says the Rashon, the most important thing. Meaning the most important thing to get to from the Torah of the psukim about tefillin is to wear tefillin and to wear kosher tefillin. That's the most important thing. Nevertheless, the Harishonim, but the earlier commentators, I don't care much earlier than Rashbam out of Rishonim, but mitoch chasidusan, because of their chasidus, because of their piety, nisasku lintos achrei hadrasha sheinikar, they involve themselves in following and leaning towards the drashos, which are the main thing. Umitoch kach lohurgalo ba'omek truta shemikra, but because of that, they didn't invest so much time in interpreting the simplest interpretation of the text. Because there's a Gemara in Brachos, they're following Chazal. Chazal say, don't teach your kids too much Chumash. It's interesting. Don't teach them too much Tanakh. Because they're different understandings. They might become drawn after it and love Tanakh so much that they never want to learn Gemara, never want to open a Gemara in their lives. They have to teach them a certain amount, right? But Vagam Amru Ha'osek B'mikra Mida, Ve'ena Mida, someone who involved Ha'osek B'Talmud, Ein Lacha Mida G'dol Mizu. The Chazal also say that someone who involves themselves in Tanakh, so it's good and it's not so good. But someone who involves themselves in Talmud and Gemara, there's nothing greater than this. And he says, when we tochach lohurgulu kolkach b'shuta shal mikros, and he says, therefore people didn't invest so much time in analyzing the text. We could have been b'sechah Shabbos, and he just means more points for this. So he says because of that, so people don't know they don't know how to interpret the simple text of the Torah because they read the psukim of Tefillin, for example. And they say, oh, I see over there that right away that it's talking about putting on tefillin, this halacha, that halacha, and they don't understand, but what's the simple version of the story? So he says, "Vegam." This is fascinating. Vegam Rabbeinu Shlomo, and also Rabbeinu Shlomo, Avi Imi, the father of my mother, Meir Einei Golesh, the illuminator of the eyes of the exiles, Shapirish Torah Nevi'im V'Ksuvim, who interpreted Tanakh, he wrote a commentary, Nasan Lev the Faris Pshutos HaMikra. Rashi always claims that he's trying to give this pshat, the simple understanding of the text. But the truth is that Rashi doesn't give the simplest interpretation. He gives the simplest interpretation based on Chazal's interpretation. So he tries to answer textual questions that you would have in the best way, but it's not the simplest interpretation. So he says, Va'afani, So to I, Shmuel bar Rabbi Meir, Shmuel the son of Meir, Chasano Zatzal, the son-in-law of Rashi, Nisvakachti imo v'lefanav. I had a vikuach, I had a disputation. I challenged him to his face. I challenged my grandfather to his face. V'hodili, and he admitted to me, She'ilu hoya lo panai, if he would have had more time, Hayatzarech la'asos perushim acherim. Ofia pashtus. he says, Rashi admitted to me, my grandfather admitted to me that if he would have had more time, he would have written like another commentary to give the simplest understanding. HaMishchad Shem B'chol Yom, that renews it every day. And then he goes on to his comment. So this commentary really could be right. So this interpretation, this comment over here really could have been the introduction to his whole sefer. So now we're going to understand. So he says even Rashi admitted that he didn't do justice to the full text, to the simplicity of the text, simplest interpretation. So Rashbam says, I'm going to do that. I'm going to fill that role. So I'm going to explain the text in the simplest way possible, that the way you would really understand it. And it's all going to be true on the level of what we call pshat, even though there are multiple layers of interpretation, some of that are much more important. So let's take a look at some of these comments. So we have a few minutes. We'll take a look at some of the comments on the Sparsha, just to get a little bit of a flavor of Rashba. So in the second source on the first page, we have Vayikra Beis Vehevia El Bnei Aaron Akohanim, they're going to bring Vakamatz Misham Melo Kumtzo. They're going to take what's translated as three fingers full of flour. This is for a Korban Mincha. You take three fingers full of flour, and what's done with it. It says, "V'hiktir kohen es askarasa." He's going to make it. Hiktir means to make it go up in smoke on the mizbeach. Es askarasa. It's askara. How would you translate askara?
Essence.
Why askara? Like a. Is it goes? Yeah. Yeah. It looks like zechach. Remember. So Rashi. I quote Rashi over here. Hakom etzola ligvoa hu zikaron hamincha. It's a memorial remembrance of the Karban Mincha Leibra. Why? Shebo Nizkar Balev Latova Lanachas Rach. Because through this, the owner is remembered, is considered for good and for Nachas Rach. It's pleasing to God. So it's called the part that you take, right? Again, there's a Karban Mincha, like in a regular Karban Mincha, usually what happens is that you take this three fingers full of the flour or of the crumbs, you put it on the mizbeach, goes up in smoke, and the rest of the bread offering that you brought is eaten by the kohanim. That's what most, some are completely burnt, but most are done in this fashion. So the part that's put on the mizbeach is called the askara, the memorial portion or something like that. Rashi says because this is the one that makes the owner remembered by God, favored by God. So let's take a look at Rashbam. Rashbam says, "Askarasa loshon zachar." It's loshon of like remembering. Zecher. Regil lomar bilavona, but he says it's normal to see this by incense nipnei hareach haola because of the smell that goes up. V'chein k'siv mazkir lavona, and he quotes a pasuk in Yeshayahu. Right, Rashbam has a mastery of Tanakh, and he quotes a pasuk from all over. V'chein ha'isa lechem la'askara. So he says that we see that. The idea of making something go up in smoke, we sometimes see the term mazkir, which means to mention or to remember or to cause to be remembered when it comes to things going up in smoke and producing a smell. It's interesting. So we see Rashbam a little bit taking from different psukim and showing a common theme. One thing that's worth noting, I think scientists have pointed out that which of the five senses is most connected to remembering. Ever hear about this?
Smell.
Yeah, have you heard that?
Mm-hmm.
Right. It's so interesting. You know, you go into a room, you smell something, and it brings certain memories. I would have thought, through sight, through sound, but it says a smell. That's what scientists bring down. And over here, we see Rashbam interpreting. He says the word of zecher, of remembering, is connected to a smell of something being produced. So Rashbam, I don't know if he knew that science. But he definitely understood the Torah in a certain way, and the Torah for sure knew the science. So he understood the Torah in a certain way that yes, there's something of being mazkir lavona. There's a memorial. There's something that's being thought out, and that's how he understands it over here. Take a look at another comment of his. So first another pasuk. This is the second to last verse on the first page. Vayikra Gimel Aleph Vimzevach Shlamim Karbono. So if you bring a Korban Shlamim, we know that there are five primary types of Karbanos. Four of them are animal Karbanos. There's an Asham and a Chatas, which are brought for particular sins. There's a Korban Ola, it's fully burnt on the Mizbeach. And then there's a Korban Shlamim. Korban Shlamim, that's the one that is eaten. Well, there's different types of Korban Shlamim, but those are eaten by the by there's part that goes to the owners, part that's burnt on the Mizbeach, part that goes to the Kohanim. So Rashi over here says, why is it called a Shlamim? What does the word Shlamim sound like it comes from?
Peace.
Right. It's often the what's the often the translation over here in like an Arutz Chumash would be a peace offering. They call it a peace offering. So it says Rashi says Shlamim Shematilin Shalom Ba'olam. Because he's first said, Rashi gives two interpretations. One is that it brings peace into the world. There's something mystical, spiritual, that there's more peace in the world when the Karban Shalom is brought. And he gives a second interpretation. Shlamim, sheyesh behen shalom, lemizbeach, lekohanim, lebaalim. That there's peace between the different parties that receive. Right? Certain karbanos are only burnt on the mizbeach. Some are have the kohen eats from and the mizbeach eats from. This one, everybody is happy. Everyone gets a cut of the pie. Everyone gets a part of it. And therefore, there's shalom brought there. Now, we turn over to the next page. So Rashbam over here says, shlamim, me'achar shein aloshon ola ino kalil. The fact that it's not, since it's not going up, it's not considered burnt. It doesn't have the lashon of olav that is fully burnt. It's not like that. El lashon shlamim, rather the lashon of shlamim is shemash lashon neder, b'tzarech l'shalim es nedarav. It's more of an expression of like someone took a vow to bring a karban, and he needs to pay it up, make good on his word. Shu lashon tashlumim. He says, what does karban shlamim mean? He says, don't translate it as a peace offering. Translate it as a pay it up offering, that you owe something, pay it up. And then the halachas are going to be, as we explain as we go on, he says, our sages say, Lashon Shalom, Shal Kol Zachin Bo. It's a lashon of peace, because everyone gets to take part in it, and then he quotes basically what Rashi is quoting, that source in Chazal. So Rashbam is not afraid of using Chazal for interpretation. He says, listen, I'm not limited in understanding the simple chances of why this is called a Korban Shlamim. He says, I'm not limited to Chazal's interpretation, but I'm not afraid of it. If I think that that's the simplest interpretation of the word Shlamim, Rashbam says, I'll go for it. But I'm not limited. I could also offer another pshat, which is that it's an expression of Tashlumin, of paying it up.
Hey, I wouldn't call it dramatically different than Rashi in this way.
No, I wouldn't.
Okay.
You know, well, it's different in that he hasn't a source for this.
Oh, so he's just going with it.
He's giving a simple interpretation of what shlamim might mean. Now, again, he's not coming from nowhere. We're talking about a man who knows all of Tanakh at his fingertips, and he knows all of Shas. So this is what we would call an educated guess, right? This is not
a. It was right.
I feel it's this. It's Rashbam. He had a Masora, which is, so he's very informed. He has Shas and he has Tanakh. And then he says, I would say Shlomim is an expression of Tashlumin, of paying up. There's even a question you can ask on this, is that not every Shlomim is that you brought a Neder. Not every, is that you made a Neder, you took a vow, and you're paying it up. Not every version is that. But if you think about it, a lot of the carbon Shlomim is like, there's one type of Shlomim, a carbon Toda. We're going to learn about that next week's Parsha Sava, carbon Toda, which is, when do you bring a carbon Toda? Every Thanksgiving, right?
So he doesn't have a true source of this. He's just going with logic out of it.
His first interpretation, yes. The second one, he's quoting Sifra, which is Midrash Halacha from the Tanaim. But the first interpretation is his own assumption. I don't think there's any source in Chazal for that. He doesn't seem to quote. He seems to imply that it's not Chazal. But a Korban Toda, so you bring every Thanksgiving, right? But really, we give whenever we make a Berchas Hagomel, right? Someone got out of prison, someone crossed the sea safely, someone got recovered from an illness, something like that. So you bring a Korban Toda. That's a type of Shlamim. And that is also kind of paying it up. Korban Pesach is a type of Shlamim. That's also paying it up. So you can say it's not just a neder, but any type of carbon shlamim, or most types of shlamim, are you're paying something forward. Whether you took a promise to, or whether you're just thanking God because you owe him, or you're thanking God for Pesach, or for Karban Chagiga that we bring on the Yom Tovim, are also, we have to pay it forward, thank God for it. There's one more comment over here. It's quite short, and we'll end with this. It says that Asher Nasi Yecheta, we're talking about different types of Karban Chatas that are brought, a sin offering. Asher Nasi Yecheta. How would you translate that phrase? A Nasi is a prince or a king. It's really referring to the king in Halacha. How would you translate this phrase? Asher Nasi Yecheta.
Prince who sinned.
And a prince who sinned. So, Rashbam would seem to agree. Who sins. All right, who will sin? And if the prince or the king will sin, and then halachos regarding his unique karban. So, Rashbam says that. He says, Asher nasi yecheta, and the king that will sin, kmo v'asher nitan keser malchus barosho, right? Rashbam's still feeling a little bit of Purim, so he quotes a pasuk from Esther. Right? He says, the one that has the kingship on it, the crown of on his head. The way you understand that pasuk, right? What is it? It's that the keser malchus is on his head. What does that mean? So he explains that pasuk in Esther is the keser malchus asher nosan brosho, and the crown that is on his head. And then, so that's how I understand it. Now, what's the significance of that? Well, so take a look at the next comment, which is Ibn Ezra. Ibn Ezra and Rashbam, they have a lot of overlap, a lot of similarities. There's actually like full essays written on whether or not Rashbam and Ibn Ezra ever interacted.
They lived at the same time, right?
They were, yeah, they were
the same year.
They were almost exact contemporaries. They were contemporaries. We'll call them contemporaries. I don't know if they had the same birthday.
I'm looking
at you. But they were contemporaries. And there's a lot of overlap in the style of their commentaries, though they disagree drastically.
4 years apart.
Okay, yeah. They disagree drastically on their approach to Pshat and Drash. Like Ibn Ezra, by the tefillin comment that we mentioned earlier, he strongly disagrees with any thought of that it's not a literal command to put on tefillin. Rashbam, while in truth wore tefillin, he didn't think that was the simplest understanding of the text. He thought that's a deeper layer of the text, but not the simplest understanding. Ibn Ezra says, no, even if it's not the simplest understanding of the text, if that's what halacha says, that's what you follow. So they had a very drastic distinction. It's a nuance, but it's very significant in how they understood Pshat and Drash. So anyway, Ibn Ezra over here, this is not so drastic, but just a slightly different translation. He says, Asher nasi yechata, hafoch. It's the opposite, right? He's also a little bit Purim, right? He says, v'hafoch, v'chinu, asher yechata nasi. If the one that will sin turns out to be a nasi, the nasi. Right, so this also is a nuance to appreciate what's going on. Rashbam interprets it as asher nasi yechata. If the one that is the king will sin, as opposed to Ibn Ezra, who says, if the one who will sin
is a nasi,
is the king.
No, I thought he meant the nasi of Shevet.
No.
So why is the word melech used at all then?
Why isn't it?
Yeah, if we're talking about the king, because nasi means prince.
Yeah,
we have nasiim.
That's a good question. In halach and already in the Mishnah, it understands these psukim of the nasi referring to the melech. Could you possibly extend it to what we call the nasiim? Could be, but that's not the point that they're arguing about. What they're arguing about is just how you interpret asher, like the one who. Are we talking about the one who sins is the king, or if the king is the one who is king sins?
I'm sorry, what's the difference?
Right. So you grammatically hear the difference? We're asking, is the one who is the king, if the one who is the king sins, or if the one who sins is the king?
Okay.
So it's a grammatical difference of the one way, who.
The king.
How we're defining it. Either way, the same fact is happening. So what is the significance in interpreting it differently? What is there something to gain? There's something to understand. So it could be the perspective of what's the main thrust of the passage that we're talking about. So Ibn Ezra, you could say he would view the whole thing as this is a passage about sins. It's about this sin right? We're talking about chatas, korban chatas. And if the sinner will be this, and if the sinner will be that, and the sinner will be with the king, if the sinner will be, we're talking about the sinner and the different flavors of sinner, right? Mm-hmm. Kohen Gadol, entire congregation, king. Well, it could be, you could suggest that Rashbam doesn't want to view it as that. He doesn't view it as just different flavors of sin, even though, of course, that's what's going on here. But rather, he says, if the one who is the king will sin, then we're kind of more focusing on the person, different qualities of people. Of course, Chazal speak about this. They say, reads Asher, because this word Asher is not used by the Kohen Gadol sinning, by anyone else. There's Asher, like Ashrei, like praiseworthy is the generation that the king is humble enough to admit that when he sins and he brings a karban, it's a very praiseworthy thing of that generation. So it could be that Rashbam is not focusing on different flavors of sinner, but different personalities and how they're supposed to react to sin. So it could be that's just splitting hair, it could be it's just nuance, but it could be that's some significance in Rashbam and Ibn Ezra. One thing I want to point out is that when you learn Rashbam and Ibn Ezra side by side, so you can appreciate a lot more, because they have such similar styles in at least their interpretation of the text. There's a lot of overlap between Rashbam and Ibn Ezra. There's a lot to gain there. So this is just a little bit of a taste of Rashbam's styling, of his controversy, and his, I guess, his non-controversy, or his con-controversy, I don't know what you call it, of really, really where he stands. And Hashem, we got an opportunity to meet Rashbam.
All right, who are you playing next?